Rahul did not exist before this episode. What they are about to describe is happening across London as you listen. This is their story. In one of England's most disadvantaged constituencies, healthcare training programs turn away qualified candidates while hospital wards struggle with chronic understaffing. The work of healing cannot be done because the institutions that prepare healers have been told to restrict their intake, as though the government that creates the currency could somehow run out of it.
I grew up above my parents' corner shop on Cranbrook Road, watching them serve our neighbourhood 16 hours a day. The shop was everything to us, but medicine was everything to me. When my sister Priya was born with a hole in her heart, I spent weeks in the waiting rooms at Great Ormond Street, watching the paediatric team work miracles, the way they explained her surgery to my terrified parents, the gentleness with which they held her tiny hand during the pre-op checks. I knew then what I wanted to do with my life. I studied biomedical science at Queen Mary University of London, graduated with a 2-1, and took a job as a healthcare assistant at King George Hospital while I applied for medical school. The work was everything I hoped. Direct patient care, working alongside consultants, seeing the difference we made every single day. I was ready to commit the next decade to training. I had the grades, the experience, the determination. My first UCAS application was rejected. Fair enough, medical school is competitive. I strengthened my personal statement, got more experience, applied again the following year, rejected again, same story the third year. Each rejection letter said the same thing. Places were extremely limited due to funding constraints. I accepted this. It sounded reasonable. Medical training is expensive, but I wanted to understand what these funding constraints actually meant. I contacted Health Education England directly, asking about medical training places in London and whether there were alternative pathways I might explore. The response was polite but clear. Their allocation had been significantly reduced by Treasury spending limits. They suggested I consider other healthcare careers while continuing to reapply. I tried the graduate entry route at Barts and the London School of Medicine and Dentistry. I had the required degree, the healthcare experience, the references. The admissions office told me the program had been suspended due to budget restrictions from NHS England. They could not say when it might resume. I should monitor their website for updates. Nursing seemed like the logical alternative. Still direct patient care. Still making a difference. Still working in the teams I admired. I applied to Redbridge College for their adult nursing degree. The admissions tutor, Mrs. Patterson, was sympathetic but firm. "We would love to take you, Rahul, but our nursing program is capped at just 24 places because we can only fund what Health Education England approves. There is no funding for more places." There it was again, no funding. I was starting to hear this phrase everywhere, from every institution I approached. It had become the standard response, the conversation ender that no one questioned. Then I saw something that made me question it. Walking past Redbridge College one evening after my shift, I noticed the lights were on in the nursing building, the windows faced the street, and I could see directly into the simulation lab. Rows and rows of training beds, high-tech mannequins, monitoring equipment that must have cost thousands. All of it completely empty. Dozens of training stations. Enough for several times the 24 students they claimed was their maximum capacity. I stood there staring through that window for 10 minutes. If the lab existed, if the equipment existed, if qualified lecturers worked in that building, what exactly was it that there was no funding for? The beds were there, the mannequins were there, the building was there. I started asking around my neighbourhood. Within 3 streets of my parents' shop, I found 5 people who wanted to train as nurses or healthcare assistants. Fatima, who had been a lab technician in Somalia before coming to the UK. James, a care worker, desperate to get his nursing degree. Sarah, who had applied to 3 colleges and been turned away by all of them. Mohammed, who had been trying to get on a healthcare assistant course for 2 years. And Elena, a former teacher who wanted to retrain after her school closed. 5 people, on 3 streets, all turned away because there was no funding. Meanwhile, our local GP surgery was collapsing. Dr. Ahmed was trying to cover over 3,000 patients by herself. The practice manager had pinned a notice to the waiting room wall, apologizing for delays and explaining they were actively recruiting, but could not find qualified staff. Appointment waiting times had stretched to 3 weeks for routine consultations. The people who wanted to do the work existed. The patients who needed the care existed. The training facilities existed. The equipment existed. What exactly was missing? I started to understand that when Mrs. Patterson said, "There is no funding," she was not describing a law of physics. She was describing a decision someone had made. The Treasury, which works for a government that issues the pound, had chosen not to spend the pounds that would connect the people on my street to the training beds sitting empty in that lab. The government that prints the notes and mints the coins told me it could not find enough of them to train the people who were standing right there, ready to work. But the real question was never about money. It was about whether the people existed. They did. Whether the skills could be taught. They could. Whether the materials were available. They were. The excuse was not a fact. It was a choice wrapped in the language of impossibility. It is the same logic as a household that says, "We cannot afford it," except a household does not issue its own currency. The government does. The limit was never the money. The limit was the willingness to spend it into the places and the people who needed it. I am still a healthcare assistant at King George Hospital. I am still applying for medical school. But I no longer accept the excuses. When someone tells me there is no funding for healthcare training, I think about that empty simulation lab, about Fatima and James and Sarah and Mohammed and Elena, about Dr. Ahmed trying to care for 3,000 people by herself. I understand now that this is not just my story. Walk through any constituency where people want to heal and patients need healing, and you will find the same gap. Someone in Westminster decided the cupboard was bare, not because the pounds did not exist, but because they chose not to create them for this purpose. That is not economics, that is politics.
What Rahul experienced has a name: fake experts. This technique works by citing economists or commentators who treat the household budget analogy as self-evident, as though repeating it makes it true. Consider how tobacco companies once paraded doctors in white coats claiming cigarettes were safe. The authority came from the costume, not the evidence. Today, politicians and commentators cite "economists say" to justify spending limits without naming which economists or acknowledging the deep divisions within the profession. When Rahul was told there is no funding for healthcare training, this was presented as economic fact rather than political choice. The fake experts behind this reasoning treat government budgets like household budgets. Money must be found before it can be spent, but the UK government issues its own currency. It does not need to find pounds before it spends them. The austerity objection claims economists say we cannot spend more on health without causing inflation. Which economists? The profession is divided. Many macroeconomists argue the binding constraint is real capacity, not currency. Economists say, without naming them, is an appeal to unnamed authority. The resources existed. The people existed. The decision not to connect them was political, not financial. Ilford South ranks 127 out of 543 English constituencies in the English Indices of Deprivation 2025, placing it in deprivation decile 3. The constituency has 860 registered charities, according to the Charity Commission Register for England and Wales. Total grants received amount to £22.7 million, according to 360 Giving Grant Nav. All sources are published at blockedbritain.co.uk. Blocked Britain tells the stories of people whose lives are shaped by the gap between what Britain needs and what its institutions choose to provide. Every character is fictional. Every situation is drawn from official statistics. Produced by Blocked Britain.